Okay, this is Stuart Bell interviewing Gary Stein at 8518 Marathon Drive, Universal City, Texas. And this is for the Oral History Vietnam project for the Vietnam Archive at Texas Tech. And today is, what is today?
15th.
It is the 15th of March at 2:19 on a Friday. So, and why don't we start off with just a few things about your childhood, where you were born, where you grew up, that kind of thing.
Okay. Well, my dad was in the Army, Army Air Corps, more specifically, and I was born on the 28th of November, 1945, in Madison, Wisconsin, and that's primarily because that's where my mother lived and grew up the later part of her youth. And so my dad and mom got married. I had an older brother. Unfortunately, he died a few years after that in a car train accident, but that's a whole different story. So anyway, I was born there. My dad, being in the service, hopped around to different places. It was during the war, or right towards the end of the war, and there was an awful lot of action, an awful lot of stuff going on, a lot of movement of people. Places starting up, but places shutting down, and so forth. So, I don't know what else to tell you.
You said you moved around a lot, and I know you moved around between the states, all over, and even Japan. And
oh, you want me to cover all that?
Okay. No, it's you don't have to cover all of it, but I could ask, which places would you say most defined your development throughout childhood?
Okay. Well, about the first place I remember being was Craig Air Force Base in Alabama. And because my dad was stationed there, you know, and obviously we went wherever he was stationed. And I can also remember being in Chicago for a couple of years because my dad was sent there to the University of Chicago to get the last 2 years of his degree, and because he was a captain major at that point. We lived in Laredo, Texas, and I have a lot of fond memories of that. He was sent to Japan when I was 10 years old, came back when I was about 13, and that was a very interesting experience. I had a brother 5 years younger than I am, and a sister 5 years younger than my brother, so 10 years younger than me. And we really enjoyed all of our assignments. Mostly fond memories. I have hardly any bad memories at all of anything growing up. After Japan, well, we lived in Nagoya first, and then Tokyo. And great memories. It was a fun time of my life. And then when we came back, Dad was sent to Philadelphia to be part of the Air Force ROTC Reserve Officer Training Corps program at St. Joe's College in Philadelphia. And we lived in Orland, a suburb of Philadelphia up to the north. And that's where I went to junior high school and then high school the first, you know, until I was in the middle of my junior year. And at that point, my dad retired, and we all moved as a family back to Alex, Oklahoma, A-L-E-X, Oklahoma. And that's where my dad was born and raised, in fact, in the same house, and stayed with my grandmother while he was looking around trying to find something to do. And that is, like I said, that was in my junior year. And that's where I met my future wife, and still wife, while we were in high school. We started dating then. And my dad was going to buy a service station, gas station, in Clinton, Oklahoma. And the bottom dropped out of that when he found out that this was going to be right downtown Clinton on Highway 66, Route 66. Found out that there were plans for the interstate to come in and bypass Clinton, Oklahoma, which of course would dramatically reduce the volume of traffic going through and the amount of gas anybody could sell. So he backed out of that and eventually ended up getting hired by the American Red Cross as a field director for the Red Cross organization on Shepherd Air Force Base in Wichita Falls, Texas. And so we moved down to Wichita Falls. So I went from, in one calendar year, a 12-month period, I went from high school in Orland, Pennsylvania, to Alex, Oklahoma, to Clinton. That was only for about a month and a half, I guess. And then to Wichita Falls. And by the time I got to Wichita Falls, I was a senior. And came into there during my senior year. And that's where I ended up graduating. And I ended up, while I was in high school, Hershey High School, Wichita Falls, I kind of fell into the Army Junior ROTC program. And I loved it. Growing up with the Air Force, my dad wasn't a pilot, but you know, most of the bases we went to had airplanes, and I was always fascinated with airplanes. And so I just assumed that eventually I would join the Air Force and become a pilot, because I loved airplanes, you know. And so in order to accomplish that, graduating from high school in Wichita Falls, the Army ROTC program had an enormous influence on my life. And Lieutenant Colonel retired Army Leo Harmon was the professor of Army military studies or whatever he was in the ROTC program there at Hershey. And he's been my lifelong hero. I love the guy. So anyway, when it came time to go to college, not being real familiar with Texas, I said, well, I'll just pick the place that's closest that has Air Force ROTC, and that turned out to be North Texas State in Denton, which is about, I don't know, 120, 30, 50 miles or whatever it is away from Wichita Falls. And so applied, was accepted, and went there and I spent 4 years. While I was there, I was in the Air Force ROTC program, of course, and was able to sign a contract with the Air Force for my junior and senior year and get paid. I think we got paid $50 a month or something like that. You know, it's a little better than that now. That allowed me to continue with the ROTC program and align myself for commissioning as an officer and then entry onto active duty. And I passed all the flight physicals and aptitude tests and all that, so before graduation, you know, I was able to get assurances of a pilot training slot. And the base I was assigned to go to was Reese Air Force Base in Lubbock. So this is a kind of a big Texas operation, you know. And I was happy because that was still in Texas. By now, I had spent 4.5 years or whatever in Texas, and I liked it. And it was close to home. So, graduated in May or June, and got married to Nell. Actually, her name is Frieda, but married her, and we had a brief honeymoon in June. That was the 28th of June. And went to Lubbock, Texas, Reese Air Force Base, and I entered active duty and Air Force pilot training on the 1st of July, 1968. Graduated from high school in whenever it was, May of 64. So that began my real career with the Air Force. While I was in college, like during my senior year, I was busy doing student teaching and ended up having to take a correspondence course at the same time I was doing everything else. I was also taking advantage of what they call the Flight Indoctrination Program. It was a program run by the Air Force for pilot candidates in Air Force ROTC units, where the Air Force paid for 34 and a half hours of flight time plus the ground school and all the stuff to go along with it at a local fixed base operator, a little local pilot training outfit. And so I was able to get that 34 and a half hours in Cessna 150. And that's kind of really where I learned to fly. I picked everything up very quickly. You know, some people take to flying naturally and some people don't. It just came naturally to me, and I have no idea why. But anyway, I had fun doing that, and so I was well prepared to go into pilot training at Reese. Flew first the T-41, which was a Cessna 172, owned by the Air Force, with only two seats. And that was really kind of a flight screening program. If you didn't show an aptitude for flying with military instructors, and a lot of them were contractors, you would be eliminated right there. It was a lot cheaper for the Air Force to find out then before you entered into starting flying jets in really a serious program where it's expensive. And so did fine there, entered into the regular part of pilot training, started flying T-37s. An archaic airplane, but it had two little jet engines, great airplane.
Is it that one right there?
That's the one. Derisively called the 6,000-pound dog whistle machine made to convert jet fuel into noise. Yeah, but it was a great airplane. And we still flew the thing here throughout Air Force pilot training until about 5 years ago. And it was replaced by a tinfoil airplane. I won't go into that. So that was great. And I was very successful flying to 37. And I was high in my class going into T-38s, which is the supersonic jet trainer. And great airplane, a lot of fun to fly. Especially in formation and cross-country and things like that. So I did well there too. And I graduated 9th out of, I think, 77 or 78 students.
Whatever. I was just making sure everything was working.
Anyway, the way the assignment process worked, 78 students received a list of 78 airplanes. And they were written on a blackboard. And the guy graduated number one. Cross his favorite airplane off, and that assignment was gone, and that was what he was going to get. And the number two guy did the same thing, number three, four, five. And so there were two fighters, and they went number one and two, and some guys picked bigger planes. A lot of guys kind of had the idea of flying for the Air Force as long as they had to, and then going out and flying for the airlines. I didn't want to do that. So when it came my turn, I had a choice between big airplanes, which I did not want to fly, being an instructor coming back to Reese. I didn't want to do that. I wanted to go to Vietnam. And an O2 or an O1. And some people thought the O2 was a better FAC airplane. I didn't. I thought the O1 was a much better FAC airplane. So I picked that. It was the last one left. And later, a couple of guys tried to argue me out of it, and I said, nope, that's the one I want. So I volunteered for it, and I knew that meant going to Vietnam, and that's exactly where I wanted to go and what I wanted to do, serve the country, do something exciting, something that not many people get a chance to do.
Right.
So that's how I ended up flying O-1s. And so I graduated then in August of 69 and had to go to Air Force Land Survival, Air Crew Survival School up in Fairchild Air Force Base up in Washington. And that was in September. It was cold up there. And we spent a lot of time in the classroom academics. Some time in what they call the Resistance Training Laboratory. It was a POW camp. We had to try to escape evade capture and get captured, and then go through mock interrogations. They made it very realistic. It was interesting because most of us have not ever done anything like that before.
Kind of put you to the real test.
They put you to the test. They put you under real stress and duress. Mm-hmm. Even though in the back of your mind, it was so realistic, in the back of your mind, you know it's a classroom environment. Mm-hmm. But it was, they made it very realistic, which is good. Otherwise, it wouldn't be any good for anybody. And what they're trying to prepare you for, obviously, is if you get shot down or otherwise captured, you know that you're going to be there a long time and you're going to go through similar but much worse experiences for days and months and maybe years, which happened to a lot of guys.
Yeah.
So this was just a kind of a quick introduction to survival, evasion, resistance, and escape if possible. Mm-hmm. Kind of goes right along with the military code of conduct. So that was fun. The real fun part was what they call the trek. And that was about 3 or 4 days out in the forest north and east of Fairchild, part of Idaho, part of the state of Washington. And we got real close to Canada. It was absolutely gorgeous up there. And I love the outdoors. So it was like a big camping trip to me. The only thing that was unpleasant was being hungry because they didn't feed us very well. But that's part of the experience too, because if you get shot down, you don't go to the nearest McDonald's and get a burger. You may have to eat berries and snakes and caterpillars or whatever it might be. So it was all part of the thing, and that's part of the stress and duress that they put you under. But all in all, a very pleasant experience, and I learned a lot.
Yeah.
It was good. And then got to go down to Florida to Tyndall Air Force Base. Actually, Eglin Air Force Base up in Valparaiso, Florida, up in the Panhandle, and they had a big bombing range complex north of there, and then the auxiliary of Eglin was Hurlburt Field, a few miles west, also along the coast, and then we actually did our training at an auxiliary of Tyndall. So the ox of an ox is kind of a strange thing. Actually it belonged to the Navy, but the Air Force was using it to do our O-1 training. And it was real close to the water too, right there on the gorgeous beaches of western Florida between Panama City and, not Panama City, Valparaiso and Pensacola. Mm-hmm. Gorgeous place. But it was serious business because we were learning, number one, how to be forward air controllers just on the ground, what all the system is that supplied all the air support to the Army troops. So basically, that's what that was about. How the Army, introduction to the Army, because most of us didn't know really much about the Army or how they worked or what we needed to do to help them and so forth. And then also to fly the O-1, airplane, O-1 Bird Dog. Also known as an L-19. Basically, it's a Cessna airplane built to run along the Cessna 170, a tail dragger. Mm-hmm. So the Cessna airplanes are usually four place, two side-by-side seats in the front, two in the back, with a steering wheel. But the O-1, or Bird Dog, as it was commonly known, was built specifically for the Army in the late 50s. And it was their kind of liaison airplane, and it was a great airplane for doing a forward air control mission because the visibility was just excellent. It was one seat. There was a fold out, kind of a sling seat that you could set up in the back. That's where the instructor would be, or if you had to carry a crew chief to install the part or move a person from one place to another, whatever it was, you could set up that little seat, but mostly it was a single seat airplane. And it, instead of a steering wheel, it had a stick, which was nice, and a throttle over on the left side, single door on the right side, and windows all around, you could fly. I think only flew normally about 100 miles an hour, 75 knots or so. So you fly with the windows open or closed. It's kind of your choice. Really a fun airplane. Had a lot of power. Didn't go very fast because of the type of propeller on it. We were more interested in climbing rapidly than going fast. But anyway, I learned to fly the O-1 and went through the Air Ground Operations School and went through the FAC course, which we called FAC-U. Pilots do stuff like that. So anyway, graduated from there and got my assignment to go to the Philippines on the way to Vietnam for the purpose of going through the Air Force Jungle Survival School, because obviously we're going to go work for a year in the jungle of Vietnam and that area. So this was only about a 5 or 6 day, I guess, course. Part of it was a little mini trek that was only a couple of days long, and a lot of classroom activity, some practical stuff. And I got to tell you, I learned a whole lot more going to that school that I thought was practical than I did at the survival school in Fairchild, which, like I said, the main thing I learned there was it's not fun to be hungry.
Yeah.
So, but I learned going to jungle survival school that I could live, I felt confident I could live in the jungle for 2 or 3 months with nothing but a machete and a knife and, you know, whatever clothes I had on my back. It was really, really a very, very good school. And then back on an airplane and flew into Saigon in the middle of the night. And as we were approaching, we could look out the window and we'd see explosions and flares and going off and all kinds of stuff. Okay, this is real. Mm-hmm. So landed at Tan Son Air Base in Saigon and spent the night there because my assignment was to go to Ben Hoa Air Base, which is about 25, 30 miles east and a little bit north of Saigon. So that's where I would went the next day. Those of us who were going, they put us on a school bus with hurricane fencing for windows, so hand grenades couldn't come in. We thought, no, this is real now.
Yeah.
So then they took us to Ben Hoa, and we checked in, and I was first assigned to the 19th TAS, Tactical Air Support Squadron, and got there in late December of 69. See if I have the date. December 21st of 69. And I was a second lieutenant still, and on the 1st of January, I was promoted to first lieutenant just by virtue of the fact that I had been in the Air Force for a year and a half.
Mm-hmm.
And that started all my in-country qualifications, even though I was a graduate of FAC-U and knew how to fly the airplane. I didn't have any experience with the real thing. We had done all the practice dropping and shooting rockets and all that kind of stuff. But that was kind of like, it was just school, you know. So you get into the real situation, that's where you really learn what's going on. And we did pretty quick. I spent some time getting qualified in country as just a pilot with the O-1. And then more FAC training and getting qualified to do that. And in the meantime, there was the 19th TAS and 22nd TAS were in the midst of a bunch of mission changes. So during that turmoil, I spent part of my time just gaining experience flying around the country by myself, navigating by looking at the ground and all this. Everything was VFR, visual flight rules. Ferrying mail, supplies, parts, and people from the headquarters, our headquarters there at Ben Hoa, out to our little outlying operating locations, one of which I would soon become part of. And so that was great. Mm-hmm. It was a good experience just flying the airplane, learning the lingo, all the air traffic control system over there, where all the places were, who some of the people were, and all that. It was a really great experience. And then the 14th of February is when the 22nd, I was assigned from the 19th task to the 22nd task, because at that point, all of the 01s were given to the 22nd task from the 19th task, and the 19th task got all the 02s. Right. So, which made sense, you know? It's hard for one squadron to do two airplanes. Mm-hmm. It makes sense for this squadron to use all the 02s, this squadron to use all the 01s. So that's when everything really started to gel. So then my first assignment away from the initial qualification was down to Sauk Trang in Forkor. But it was a beautiful place. Way down the delta, right on the Mekong River delta down there. That's why they called it the delta, obviously. And I was supporting MACV, which is Military Assistance Command Vietnam, basically the Army. I was supporting Advisory Team 71 there at Sauk Trang. Sauk Trang, big place. We had a 3,000-foot runway, paved runway. It was enormous by 01 standards. Very nice facility. And had some pretty cool adventures while I was there. And at that point, I got my full combat qualification as a sector FAC and air liaison officer. That's when I became an air liaison officer. It was generally an ALO, or air liaison officer, generally is a guy who is more senior and he is in charge of two or three other facts. If you're the only fact there, you're the fact forward air controller, plus you are the ALO. So you do all the coordination with the Army to find out what they want you to do, tell them what they can do for you, what you can do for them, and then you go out and fly the missions and do what you had coordinated with them. The Army guys were pretty good. I remember one time going into the brigade, or I always get the Army things mixed up. Whatever the advisory team commander was, he was an Army lieutenant colonel, and we were working on a pre-planned airstrike. They were going to put a bunch of their troops in using a helicopter insertion at a particular place, and he wanted to soften the area up first with air support, and he had 7 point targets that he wanted hit around the landing zone. And I mean, it was all a small area, you know, within a 5-block radius. And he said, so I need 7 airplanes with 1 bomb, and I want them to all drop their bombs at the same time on this. And I said, well, all due respect, you're not going to get that. That doesn't make any sense. That's not the best way to use the air support that we can give you. I will fly overhead. I'll get the airplanes for you, and we'll probably have a flight of 3 F-100s, for example. And they'll be briefed in advance, because I go talk to them in advance on the ground, on exactly what the target is, what the requirements are, what the time phasing is, where you guys are going to be, and the fact that I need them to hit these 7 targets as relatively quickly as possible. It'll all be done within a course of about 10 minutes. So you're not going to get 7 airplanes with 1 bomb apiece. You'll get 3 airplanes with probably 4 bombs apiece, in case we need to do some extra stuff, or I can have them drop 2 bombs at a time, you know, depending on how it works out. And you say, oh, well, okay, that's fine. So that's the job of the ALO, part of the job of the ALO, to advise the Army commander on the best way to use the air power assets that would be available to him. So anyway, I spent quite a lot of time there at Sauk Trang. Well, I guess not a lot of time. It's February and March. And that was in the Ba Sim province. Well, before I was there, Time magazine had done an article on the lush, quote, lush Bashwin province. I never got to see it, but everybody talked about it. Look it up. Again, this was February and March of 1970. So, anyway, it'd be interesting to see that. It was a beautiful place. It was absolutely gorgeous. Palm trees and rubber plantations, and canals everywhere, and rice paddies in between. Really neat place. And my call sign, used a different call sign every time you moved around, you know, to a different tactical control party or a different advisory team. So I was David. David was the call sign of our group down there in the south, mm-hmm. the Delta. My number was David 31. So anyway, then in March through mid-May, I moved to a different place supporting advisory team 51. Place called Baklu. Now this is not as big, about a 1,500 foot little strip, no pavement. It was all red dirt down here, and it had pierced steel planking for the runways, which was sections of steel. I don't know, they may have been 10 feet long and maybe 3 feet, 4 feet wide. Heavy gauge steel, about maybe an eighth of an inch, mm-hmm. and they were made so that they hooked together. You could hook them, lay one down, hook it to the next one, and they pretty soon you could cover a pretty good surface with it. Then they had holes punched all in this. That's what they call pure steel planking, and so it made an actually a pretty nice runway surface. Mm-hmm. Problem was when it rained, if it got real muddy. The stuff would slide around, it was just slicker than anything when you're trying to operate on the thing, land and take off and taxi. But anyway, that's what we had down there. And I stayed there until mid-May of 70. And I got a message through the Army saying that the next day I was to report to a place called Rockjaw, R-E-C-H-G-I-A, and it was up on the close to the Cambodian border on the very western shore of Vietnam, of the Delta down there. And they wouldn't tell me what I was doing or anything. I just had to pack all my stuff and be there. So I said goodbye to the advisory team commander and my roommate, who actually was a major, he was an Air Force doctor. That's a whole different story. Cool guy. Packed up my stuff and said goodbye to my crew chief. And I got my airplane with all my stuff and flew off to Rockjaw. And when I got there, I found out that there were several other facts there. I guess altogether we had maybe 8 or 10. And we were staying in a place downtown. On the economy, it wasn't really a base, but there was a runway down there. So, anyway, the whole idea behind this was what I found out was a top secret operation flying into Cambodia to do the same kind of stuff that we had been doing in country in South mm-hmm. Vietnam. And so that's why they didn't tell us in advance what the thing was all about. We just showed up there and took us in and briefed us on this program. And nobody was supposed to be in Cambodia because they were a neutral country, but we were going to. So
the Vietnamese were there.
What's that?
The Vietnamese were there, so you got to go.
Well, yeah, they were. Yeah. The bad guys were there, that's right. So it wasn't just the Viet Cong
right.
anymore. This was the North Vietnamese. Mm-hmm. And they were quite a bit more potent an adversary than the guys we usually had been fighting.
And you had been fighting BC mostly up to this point, being in South Vietnam.
Yeah, exactly.
So did you notice a shift in, I guess, any tactics, weaponry, ferocity?
They had they were better supplied with weapons, had meaner weapons,
mm-hmm.
More potent weapons, better trained, better organized, I don't know that they were any more enthusiastic mm-hmm. about their job, but they were tough. Mm-hmm. They were tough, and I mean, we always took the BC seriously too, because they could kill you.
Yeah.
But we really took these guys a little more seriously, primarily because of their training and the weapons that they had to employ against us. So yeah, it was a little more serious business. So then from mid-May to the end of May, I flew in and out of Cambodia. Strange thing, while I was there, I still used the David 51 call sign mm-hmm. that I'd used at Bok Lu, but for some reason it really just never made any sense. When we'd take off as David 51, head for the border, and as, when we crossed into Cambodia, we suddenly became somebody else. And my call sign there was Tilly 05. And so then while I was in Cambodia, I was Tilly 05. And when I came back to go back to Rockjaw, across the border, I suddenly became David 51 again. I don't know. It didn't make any sense to me. Of course, I was just a pilot, just doing the job. You know, mm-hmm. somebody obviously thought that that was important for political reasons or something. Anyway, did some pretty interesting facking in Cambodia, Rockjaw. And after that short thing was over with, then about the 20th of June, then I went back to the Delta. To a place called Camau, C-A-M-A-U, and it's just about as far south and as you can get in South Vietnam. It was right on the very tip down there. Not as pretty as the other places because there wasn't as much foliage and trees and all that, but it was still kind of neat. And the runway there was like 1,200 feet long. It was surrounded by concertina wire and had minefields all around it. So it was a little more sporty. And so that I was still David 51, but I was flying supporting advisory team 80. Mm-hmm. And then things were kind of winding down there in the Delta, and I was assigned to a place called Khao Lan, C-A-O-L-A-H-N, and that was June and July of 70. And there I was the sector FAC and the ALO, working with several other FACs.
Mm-hmm.
And my call sign was David 73. So that was interesting. And then,
and was that the first time you had to be an ALO working with several other
folks? Most of the time I wasn't the ALO there.
Yeah.
I had been the ALO at the first three places.
Mm-hmm.
I had been. Well, not while we were flying in to Cambodia, although I retained my, well, when we were in country, I retained my call sign because I knew I'd be going back to it.
Right.
I was the ALO and the FAC there because it was just me
mm-hmm.
and in my airplane, and so I was both. And when I first got to Khao Lan, I was the ALO for just a few days, and then I was then just a FAC when another more senior guy came in. So that was, and it didn't really make any difference. It was just who did what to who, you know.
Right.
So anyway, I was David 73, and then on the 19th of July, I was assigned to back to Benoit, where I had started out as a Benoit sector FAC, and that was also our squadron headquarters and big place. We had lots of stuff going on at Benoit, two big 10,000 foot runways. Big base,
right?
So it was really nice, and I was a number two guy there, so my call sign was Kenny Kenny was the call sign for the Benoit area, mm-hmm. and in Three Corps, and then, so I was Kenny 4-2. You can kind of tell the pecking order by the call sign, you know. The last digit, if you were the number one guy, your number was 1, and then 2, and 3, and on like that. So, so I was Kenny 4-2. Anyway, I stayed there as Benoit Sector Fact from July through October as a Benoit Sector Fact. That was a great job. We sometimes worked together. There was another fellow that I became good friends with, and we would not in the same airplane, but we would fly kind of. We weren't supposed to fly formation, but we would fly in the same general vicinity,
right.
And go out to put in airstrikes, and we would help each other coordinate for clearances, and also talk to the fighters. One guy's putting in strikes, so you didn't have to work all three radios at the same time. We just kind of swap off doing stuff, and that was pretty cool stuff. So anyway, on the 18th of October, my tour in Vietnam ended, and I had 400 and some combat missions and 510 combat hours in the 01, from January 70 to 15th of October. I remember reading something somewhere about what the AFSC was. I was a 1444B, which is Spartan Forward Air Controller. Mm-hmm. That was basically it. So that was Vietnam. While towards the end of my tour there, I was trying to work an assignment for follow-on, and most of the guys were going to B-52s and KC-135s and things like that. And nothing against those guys, but again, I did not want to fly big airplanes. It just didn't interest me at all, partially because I had no aspirations to fly for the airlines. I just wanted to fly. I like flying upside down.
Mm-hmm.
Can't do that in those big airplanes. So I had put in a request to, number one, to go back to Reese because I was familiar with the area, liked it. Flying was really good there. And I wanted to be a T-38 instructor pilot. And sure enough, that's the assignment I got. And so in October, I left and went back to Reese, and for my pilot training, my pilot instructor training, I went out to Tyndall Air Force Base for the academic portion, which was about 2 weeks long, how to be an instructor, et cetera, et cetera. And then went back to Reese to go through the local version of the pilot instructor training program in the airplane, because the Air Training Command was in the process of moving the entire PIP, or pilot instructor training operation, from Tyndall down to Randolph,
right,
which is where I eventually ended up anyway. But they didn't have the airplane set up down here at Randolph, so they did all my instructor training in the airplane up at Reese, and got qualified as an instructor in 38 and stayed there. And I don't know if you want to know anything beyond that. Most of the rest of my career was instructing in the T-38 or instructing in the T-37, mm-hmm. running flying training programs, anything to do with it, including coming down to Randolph to work in the headquarters of Air Training Command. First in the Plans and Programs Division. I was the Program Objective Memorandum Division Chief for ATC, which meant looking out 5 years budget-wise, planning-wise, trying to line up all the programs that we wanted to do, pilot training, tech training for kids coming in, learning all kinds of disciplines, and then going to the Pentagon and briefing the bigwigs up there on what ATC's plans for the next 5 years were, and trying to get them to commit money so that we could execute those programs. Right. And that was okay. I wasn't flying while mm-hmm. I was doing that. And I want to fly again, so I got myself transferred over to the Air Training Command Inspector General shop, and spent the last almost three and a half years working for the IG as the Chief Flying Inspector for the entire Air Training Command, flying around, going to different places, and flying with a lot of people and looking at great programs. Looking at some not great programs, trying to help them fix them. It was thoroughly enjoyable. And then I retired on the last day of December of 1990 mm-hmm. Here at Randolph. And that was the end of the active duty Air Force career. A month later, I started up what was the first of its kind in Air Training Command. Up until then, all flying training in the airplane, all academics having to do with pilot training, and all instruction in the flight simulators for the airplanes was done by active duty IPs, instructor pilots. But in order to, one cost-saving thing that, incidentally, I had suggested while I was doing the POM thing, it just happened to work out, was that Air Training Command should use contractors, retired or separated, experienced T-38, T-37 instructor pilots to instruct in the flight simulators. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, what a great resource. And they're stable. You don't have to move them every 2 or 3 years. You don't have to send them to school. You don't have to, none of the other stuff that active duty guys have to put up with.
Right.
You have a nice stable force. You know. And so we started that thing on the 1st of February at Reese as a kind of an experiment by Air Training Command. And it was so successful that luckily for me, when Congress decided to close a bunch of bases, they decided to close Reese. The company that I worked for was able to get a contract to provide that same academic simulator instruction support, plus the academics, plus navigator training at all of the Air Force pilot training bases except Reese, which was being closed, and including the pilot instructor training mission and navigator training mission at Randolph.
Mm-hmm.
So it was seamless. I moved from Lubbock down to Universal City, bought a house four doors up from where I had lived before when I was on active duty in the headquarters. And that's where we're sitting right now. And worked for the same company. I came within 4 months of spending 20 years with the same company doing the academics and simulator and all that job. I ran the whole time I was the chief of the T-38 instructor branch.
Mm-hmm.
So it was great. I was able to use my expertise. I was able to still work with guys that I knew and trusted, retired Air Force pilots for the most part. Everybody had extensive experience as instructors.
Mm-hmm.
Guys who, you just tell them what you wanted done and they would do it. It was incredible. And everybody was real happy. And then a decision was made at the White House level to cancel a bunch of contracts and convert those to civil service, convert those jobs to civil service. In other words, civilians owned by the Air Force.
Mm-hmm.
And I had planned to retire in a year anyway and was financially set up pretty well, so instead of becoming a civil servant for a year, I decided to retire, mm-hmm. completely retire. And you can see a big smile on my face. It's been 2 years and almost 6 months, almost 6 months, 2 years and 6 months since I retired. That was a great step. And I'm happy as I can be. And I'm glad I'm not still out there doing that, because I go out and I talk to my guys who are still doing that job, and most of them are absolutely miserable. Mm-hmm. They took about a $19,000 a year pay cut, first of all, and the working conditions are not the same. They're just drones now, right, doing the mission, and it's, they don't look forward to coming to work every day like we used to back in the old days. Anyway, that's a long story. So here I am. I don't know what else you want to know.
Well, just a few more general questions. Okay. How would you evaluate the command structure while you were in the Air Force in Vietnam, and did it change any when you got out?
Well, I think it's pretty well known that, first of all, let me say that I fully understand and absolutely agree with the idea that the military does whatever the civilian government tells it to do. I understand that, and that's the way it should be. Otherwise, you end up with a military state with the military running everything, and that is not the United States. That's not how we're set up, and I hope it never comes to that. But what it also means is that decisions are made by politicians. In a lot of cases, they have no military background, no service. Military commanders, for the most part, have nothing but the best interest of the mission, and let me back up, not the mission, but the people. Mm-hmm. Because the people, you got tanks and bombs and guns and airplanes and things like that, but it's the people that get the job done. And that's your primary resource, whether you're talking about the Navy or the Army or the Air Force or the Marines or any service. You got to take care of the people first, because tanks and bombs and guns and airplanes don't do anything sitting on the ground by themselves. You got to have the people to operate them, to maintain them, to support them, et cetera, et cetera. So, the military commanders almost always have the best interests of the people at heart in accomplishing the mission. Mission comes first, always. And then in a big conflict, you're going to lose people. You're going to lose airplanes and tanks and that kind of thing too, but you're also going to lose people. So you try to get the mission done with that in mind. And it's always a tough decision to send people into combat where they might not come back.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just part of getting the mission done. That makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, a lot of the tactics that were used by the people down through the military commanders in Vietnam, down to the people, didn't make any sense militarily. They were products of the civilian leadership, based on politics.
Mm-hmm.
And so, geopolitics makes sense. You got to get the big picture up there. And the military does whatever's best for the country based on what the civilian leadership says. But sometimes civilian leadership doesn't really understand the military, and put constraints on them that make it very difficult to get the job done without unacceptable losses. And everybody who in the military who went to Vietnam, whether they realized it or not, were subject to those sometimes seemingly whimsical decrees from the military leadership, and usually started with the president and went right on down through Secretary of Defense and then even the State Department and so forth. But yeah, some of the decisions were really stupid. For example, and this didn't really affect me directly, but it's just an example of the kind of things that can be done. When we were flying fighter bombers and B-52s into North Vietnam, anybody who's done any military flying will tell you, in combat, will tell you that you want to vary the ingress and egress ingress going to the targets from mm-hmm. out of country, and then egress going back out of country. You don't want to be at the same altitude, on the same ground track, at the same times every day, with the same kind of airplanes, using the same radio frequencies, etc., because it only takes a couple of days of that for the bad guys to figure out, all right, first airplanes are going to show up, the first B-52s are going to show up at 10:30 in the morning, and they're going to be at 30,000 feet, mm-hmm. and they're going to be coming in along this line, and there are going to be six cells of three airplanes. And we'll take off a few minutes before that, and we'll be able to meet them. We'll have our surface-to-air missiles all tuned up and ready to go, so we can shoot. Well, that's exactly what the civilian leadership in the White House had the B-52 guys doing, day after day after day. And it's like, you know, you go to a carnival, and you go to that place where you have the little air rifles and you have the little ducks going by. Well, that's pretty predictable. Mm-hmm. You know, if you miss one, you know where to look for the next one. There's always going to be all these ducks in a row. Well, that's what the North Vietnamese knew. They knew where the airplanes were coming, what kind they were, what kind of defenses they had, what time they were going to get there, what altitude, what headings, and all that, both going in and coming back out, which is criminal to me. Mm-hmm. You're setting yourself up for tremendous losses, and we had tremendous losses in those airplanes. A bunch of brave people who had no choice but to do what their leaders, military leaders, don't do because they had no choice. They couldn't not do what the civilians told them to do and how they wanted to do it. I blame President Johnson and Robert McNamara, the Secretary of Defense. Department of Defense is not Ford Motor Company. You can't run Department of Defense like that. It's stupid decisions. Nor can you run it like the hill country of Texas or the U.S. Senate. It just doesn't make any sense. But, yeah, I would like to think that those decisions made sense to those people. But I just can't imagine the kind of thinking that went into demanding that. And it wasn't just for a little while, it was for years and years, off and on, you know, depending on when we were going in the north. And that's just one example of the kind of leadership I thought was really stupid and wasteful and counterproductive. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't just the, here's an idea how we countered it. There was Operation Bolo. Most of the time, you had a bunch of F-105s coming in to bomb targets in North Vietnam. And they typically flew a very predictable route in, and then a lot of times the route back out made it pretty predictable too. Because they had to meet tankers going in, and then had to meet tankers again coming out to refuel. Long ways in, long ways out. Well, there was a wing commander in Thailand who said, you know, our guys are getting clobbered going in at the same altitude, same airspeed, same everything, same radar signature on the North Vietnamese radars. Every time they would send the MiGs up and just clobber, you know. So let's do something tricky here. He said, we will get a bunch of F-4s, which are maneuverable fighters with guns and air-to-air missiles and all that mm-hmm. kind of thing. And we will take off, fly the same formation, use the same radio call signs. We'll look just like a bunch of F-105s coming in. And when the Vietnamese send up their MiG-21s, they're going to be in for a shock because we're not going to be a bunch of thuds. We're going to be a bunch of F-4s. And it was great. I mean, we took them by surprise, and they didn't know what hit them. But we couldn't do that very often. You know, that was not the popular thing to do.
Right.
Operation Bolo, look it up. It was awesome. So, anyway, I didn't think much of the civilian leadership, politically or militarily.
But the military structure within the military, you thought?
Well, the lower the level, the better it was.
Mm-hmm.
At the higher levels, some of the general officers, the higher they get, the more influenced they are by politics,
mm-hmm.
outside politics and politics within the military. In other words, they seem as much or more interested in their careers as they are in really doing the right thing for
right.
the troops at the highest levels. Well, and you even see wing commanders, Air Force level commanders, that kind of thing, who are more interested in their careers. Usually not so much during an active war, but it was still there. Trying to take care of themselves first instead of their troops. So instead of putting their foot down and telling them that you can't make us do this anymore because your decisions are causing us to lose airplanes and people, and it's stupid. Not many of our senior leaders were willing to stand up and say that. So from that aspect, even though we had guys in those positions who should have known what was going on and should have had the guts to stand up and say that, a lot of them didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And so we ended up, because of that, parochialism, selfishness, losing a lot of hardware, but mostly losing a lot of great people.
Right.
Yeah, terrible. I think it was despicable. So anyway, you asked, that's my opinion.
And I know you spent quite a bit of time with the Army on the ground when you weren't flying. Did you see the same sort of problems in that structure as well?
Not really. Not with the people that I worked with most of the time. They were dedicated people. They were not like the Air Force.
Mm-hmm.
They had a whole different philosophy of how to get along and run the war and all that kind of thing. But they had good leadership, I think, for the most part. And so did we in the Air Force. You know? Yeah, we had a lot of good people. Yeah, the Army's always been different.
Mm-hmm.
But I enjoyed working with them. I really thought it. Part of my job as the ALO was to tell them, you know, just tell me what you want to accomplish,
mm-hmm.
and I'll tell you how you can help how I can help you get the best results out of the Air Force. And so once you convince them of that, you know, a lot of people are hard-headed. A lot of military people are hard-headed, and it's hard to convince them sometimes that they don't really understand everything that they think they do, or that they would like for you to think they think they do. That was an important part of the job, but the real fun part was the actual flying.
Right.
I always loved flying, so and that was a great place for a young guy right out of pilot training. Had absolutely enormous responsibility, doing very important stuff, and growing up, until I got back to Benoit toward the end of my tour over there, I had almost no supervision on a day-to-day basis.
Mm-hmm.
It was me and my airplane and my crew chief and sometimes radio operators. And I would fly when I wanted to, don't fly if I didn't want to. If I didn't feel good, I wouldn't fly. If the weather was bad, I didn't fly. It was amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Great way to grow up as a young guy.
Mm-hmm.
Especially when it started getting into weather and stuff like that.
Right.
So I thought that most of the military leadership, the lower level you got, the better it was. As you started working your way up towards the top, it was more political, military political and civilian political.
Mm-hmm.
Became worse and worse. But I even see that in peacetime,
mm-hmm.
quote unquote peacetime too. So, but in peacetime, those kinds of decisions and those kind of motivations generally don't get people killed.
Mm-hmm.
And in that case, they did. So, that's my feeling. Does that answer your question?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
And just probably about two more questions, and I think we can have closing thoughts. But
okay.
You talked a lot about training, and do you feel that training really prepared you for what you went into in Vietnam?
Well, you can really never get enough training. You can't have too much training for something like that, because nothing that you do in peacetime, in a peacetime environment without people shooting at you, really prepares you for being shot at and shooting back, and the fog of war that everybody talks about, it's absolutely real. Here you are, a young guy right out of pilot training, in sometimes very confusing situations where you got your troops on the ground, American and Vietnamese, and maybe you can't see them because it's a thick jungle.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't know exactly where they are. Maybe they're on the move. You got bad guys who may be chasing them. They may not be separated by a river. And maybe you don't have fighters available right away. You had to call for some immediate air. And maybe the guys they sent you don't have the right kinds of weapons. Maybe they've got bombs with daisy cutter fuses, extended fuses on the end, so that they blow up above the ground. Maybe all they have is napalm and you're going after hard targets. There's so many things going on, and the situation is obviously changing very rapidly, and you're talking with the Army on their FM, maybe as they're on the run, and maybe they can't talk very loud because they don't want to be heard by the bad guys
mm-hmm.
close by. And so that's one set of coordination. You got to get it right. Then you're talking with your own guys on VHF or Victor, and they're trying to coordinate and get the fighters for you and get the clearances from the Army, from the civilian, from the Vietnamese military,
mm-hmm.
Civilian leadership, Vietnamese Army and our Army, Air Force. And then you got fighters checking in, maybe three sets of them.
Right.
And you got to brief them all, and you got to have some hold high and dry while you employ the first set. And, I mean, it is. The communications and decision making is just enormous, absolutely enormous. And you can't make mistakes because people die.
Mm-hmm.
And it might be you know, or maybe the guys in the fighters, or maybe the guys on the ground. Boy, you learn fast. And nothing really can prepare you for that. But that's why it took about 2 months to get completely combat qualified
mm-hmm.
Once I got in country. And, you know, we have facts now in Afghanistan. We had them in Iraq, too. Not airborne facts,
mm-hmm.
because the low-altitude flying environment doesn't allow little airplanes to be scooting around at low altitude, going slow. They just wouldn't last very long. So the facts we have now are generally, they're still Air Force guys. They are usually enlisted guys, and they're called JTACs, Joint Terminal Attack Controllers. And they do the same thing we did, but they can't see everything from the air. They're right there on the ground, Air Force guy embedded with the Army on the patrols, mm-hmm. and the Special Forces. And we have our own Special Forces guys who most people don't even know about, combat controllers. And they're out with the SEALs or the Army SF guys. Doing the same thing. You know, they've got all the radios, they do all the coordination, but they have to do it from right there on the ground. They have some advantages, too, in that they have GPS they can use for location of themselves and the enemies. They can laser designate in a way that the enemy doesn't see it, a target that the guys in the air can see it using mm-hmm. their special equipment, and they can drop a bomb right where the guy on the ground is shining the laser and all that kind of stuff. So the concept is still going. It'll never stop, and when you have troops in contact like that, close close contact type stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that we were able to, for the most part, get away with flying airplanes to do the mission. I don't know how I got off on that.
Well, it was interesting. So, and really the last question before, say, we can call a break.
Okay.
Is, do you personally believe that the war needed to be fought?
I did. I believed in the reason that we were over there, and that was to stem the spread of communism in Indochina, mm-hmm. in that region of the world. That was during the Cold War, and communism was a growing threat, much more so than it is today.
Mm-hmm.
The South Vietnamese broke free from North Vietnam and had a democratic-type government. Well, not like ours, but
mm-hmm.
It was essentially a democracy, on paper anyway, and working towards that. And we were trying to help them do that and get out from under the iron fist of the communists in the North. With their close association with both, at the time, with both Soviet Russia and the Chinese. So, yeah, I think it was the right thing to do. I still do. I did at the time, and I do now. And I think it's a shame that we expended so much treasure and blood over there during the long war, both in country and out of country, Cambodia, Laos, and essentially we just gave up because we weren't able to prosecute the war. We weren't able to win a war that we were fully capable of winning, and it was all politics. It was all the civilian politicians. And so we did all that for nothing, and bottom line was the communists took over anyway.
Mm-hmm.
In spite of everything that we had done. And we lost a lot of people. The South Vietnamese lost a lot of people. And we just kind of abandoned them. And I always have a bad taste in my mouth for that. But I think it was the right thing to do. I think it was a just war. It was just extremely poorly executed on our part. Not because of military people, but because of the civilian people. Very selfish.
Mm-hmm.
So does that answer your question?
Yes, sir.
I have strong opinions about it, obviously.
Yes, sir.
Because I lost friends over there, too.
Mm-hmm. Well, do you have any closing thoughts?
I kind of do. I see us doing a lot of the same kind of thing in Afghanistan. We put a lot of treasure in. And a lot of people, a lot of great people, very dedicated. And the people now are in the military for a long time have all been volunteers. Nobody's drafted.
Mm-hmm.
They get in there because they want to, and they're really motivated, and they're smart. They're well-trained, great, great people. And we've lost a lot of those great people. And we're in the process of backing out of the whole thing again, just like we did in Southeast Asia. And I think it's just pitiful that we're doing it. I think it's despicable that we're doing that. When we could win, if we'd go at it like we really wanted to, like we did in World War II, we could win that. We could have won Vietnam if we'd gone at that like we did in World War II. But it was all a political war, and again, the military is subservient to the political process, but
mm-hmm.
Some of the decisions that the politicians make are really stupid and short-sighted, I think, the way they use the military.
Yeah.
So, that's it.
All right.
Thank you for the opportunity to tell my side of the story.
Well, thank you for telling it.
Someday I would look forward to seeing what comes out of this and seeing what the entire project has to offer as far as history.
Mm-hmm.
I know you a lot of good people are being interviewed. It'd be interesting to see what a lot of other people's opinions are.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe some who were not involved in the same thing, but also some who were.
Mm-hmm.
So look forward to seeing. And thank you for taking the time to do this, allowing me to do it.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you again.
All right. So. So you got all this nonsense.